To Make Us Public Sport by Petra.
Ethel as Jeffrey.
Riganim as Anna.
Bessie Boo as Taser.
X-Man-Hater as Sidney Crosby.
Marianas as Duncan Keith.
Kirawa as Seabrook and Juliet.
Piscaria as Flory.
Rhea314 as Ellen.
Celia as Rink Manager.
Fishy as Daughter Mackenzie.
Potfick Lover as Darren.
And Templemarker as the narrator, Niedermeyer, cameraman, mother, and coach.
No!
Jeffrey said the first time, the second time, the third time, and the fourth time. Anna went to his office and gave him a pleading look in case he was willing to relent this once for her sake. He'd said
no
to Richard,
no
to every board member who spoke to him, and
no
to Ellen. Ellen had said,
sorry, but I told you he'd say no.
What Anna had that Ellen didn't was that she knew the kinds of deals advertisers generally cut with the theaters and the kinds of celebrity endorsements that might result. Instead of asking Jeffrey again, possibly for the seventh time, she said,
the deal is in place whether you refuse or not, and we can't afford to alienate our new sponsor. If you're unwilling to work with the celebrity actors...
They are not actors,
Jeffrey said, throwing up his hands and sounding as though he was on the edge of bellowing, though at least if he bellowed at Anna, he wasn't starting arguments with ghosts.
Then they'll do the commercials without your assistance.
I can't think of anything more counterproductive than having...
There was a lacuna in Jeffrey's speech that suggested expletives deleted.
Hockey players talk about our theater.
I can,
Anna said, and played her trump card.
They're not going to talk about the theater in the advertisements. They're reading short speeches. They can do those speeches with or without your assistance.
Jeffrey went pale.
I thought they were going to deliver the standard pabulum with labored hockey puns. The official theater festival of the 2010 Canadian Olympic ice hockey team, blah blah puck, in lieu of fuck, blah 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 phallic imagery.
That was the original concept for the ad series, actually. But one of the managers involved mentioned that he did drama when he was in high school and changed the scripts.
For a moment, Anna feared that Jeffrey was going to pull out all of his hair at once. He raged at the ceiling in an incoherent noise that sounded a little like,
Richard!
Then slumped.
This is ludicrous. No one would go to see hockey if a great actor were on the ice in an ad. Why would anyone go to see a play just because a hockey player attempts to act in an advertisement? And I use the term attempts advisedly.
Anna smiled tightly at him.
The manager said, and I quote,
she read the notes from the meeting from her clipboard.
Anyone who can get a Hamlet worth watching out of Jack Crew can teach Sidney Crosby how to say five lines of Henry V convincingly.
After a period of spluttering, Jeffrey said,
I didn't get anything out of Jack he didn't bring to the role.
But his voice was quiet and resigned.
I'll set up the first meeting for Tuesday,
Anna said. Jeffrey looked at the six athletes in front of him, each of them pulled away from his normal schedule for the commercials and flown in on a red-eye for one whole day in New Burbage to learn and deliver some of the most difficult lines in the canon. They had to finish the taping in time to get the commercials out prior to the Olympics. No previews, no dress rehearsal, just the performance.
This is going to be almost impossible,
he said to wake them up.
Almost,
one of them said. They weren't wearing jerseys or name tags, so Jeffrey didn't remember what that one's name was, only that he was the one who would be butchering Mark Antony. There wasn't enough inflection in the man's voice to make it a question. Jeffrey revised his estimates downward.
Practically impossible. It is nearly inconceivable that each of you will be able to read more than three consecutive words of the greatest drama in English in such a way that anyone will want to watch you without cringing.
They made a grumbling noise en masse, and the mental image of what could happen to a lone actor in a conference room with Olympic athletes who felt their masculine honor was being impugned occurred to Jeffrey. He held up his hand, hoping he could finish his thought. If they couldn't take criticism, the project was over before it could begin. They fell quiet, and he let out his breath in relief.
I've been told that you gentlemen specialize in nearly impossible feats, such as zipping across a sheet of ice at incomprehensible speeds while shepherding a small piece of rubber and avoiding other people, some of them even larger than you.
Another one laughed. That one was reading from Henry V, if the manager had his way. Jeffrey was quietly relieved that no one expected Prince Hal to laugh at Agincourt. It was an extremely undignified laugh, but at least he got the joke.
That said, this is a different area of human endeavor, quite removed from your natural habitat.
None of them laughed at that. Jeffrey clapped his hands once.
So we will begin in situ.
In what?
Asked the young man, who was, in a tour de force of truly bad punning, their puck of sorts. Jeffrey had never seen a puck with a soul patch, but he'd been told he didn't have costuming or makeup authority, and couldn't ask them to do anything to change their presumably highly recognizable faces. Anna had warned him that hockey players were at least as superstitious as actors doing the Scottish play, and she'd said it in those words because she had spent too long around actors. If keeping a soul patch meant that they could get through the day without anyone spinning in circles and spitting, so much the better.
Do you know anything about A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Jeffrey asked the barely bearded boy. He frowned and took long enough to consider the question that Jeffrey had a faint stirring of hope in his bosom, but when Puck finally answered in a thick French-Canadian accent, the hope died.
I'm supposed to read from that one, but no. No idea.
You're supposed to inhabit the role,
Jeffrey corrected him.
One does not merely read a play any more than one merely skates in a hockey game. And you?
Jeffrey snapped his fingers at the oldest, the captain, the one tasked with Hamlet for reasons obscure to Jeffrey.
You're doing to be or not to be. What does it mean?
The man shrugged. The guy's having a bad day.
A terrible day,
Jeffrey said.
The worst of days, a day so dark he would prefer not to continue on, and I sympathize with him on that score at the moment, I assure you. However, he must go on, the play must go on, and we have an appointment at the local skating rink in 30 minutes.
Prince Hal raised his hand like a child in a classroom and waited until Jeffrey said,
Yes?
Before he asked his question.
We're not here to skate.
No,
Jeffrey agreed.
Do you know your lines?
We are happy?
Stop, please.
Jeffrey took a deep breath and did not storm out. He barely looked for a trapdoor that might let him escape, since he knew there was no such thing in the conference room.
Is that the tone of voice you used to rally the troops before a deadly battle?
That made the boy blush, which was the most emotion he'd managed thus far.
No.
Then it's the wrong tone of voice for this speech. Your nominally adoring public doesn't want to see you do this poorly. They want to see you the way they imagine you to be. Noble warriors on the fields of war. Patriots battling for the good of the country through the dubious medium of sporting events.
Jeffrey waved his hand at his so-called Hal again.
Have you ever been on a stage for anything but an award ceremony? Precisely. Your milieu is the ice, so we will go there.
The camera crew met them there and hovered with their staring glass lenses, ready to shoot any footage that could possibly be useful, which included players complaining about their parts as pitifully as any seasoned actors.
Why do I have to read the speech about burying Julius Caesar?
Asked the man with Mark Antony's speech on his index cards. The players were in their Team Canada jerseys, which allowed Jeffrey to identify his clueless Mark Antony as Taze. There was only one camera watching the bench where Jeffrey sat, an unwilling coach cradling a double-double to his chest. The rest followed the players warming up on the ice.
Because at that point in the play, he is dead,
Jeffrey said, in case Taze honestly didn't know.
Caesar was trying to consolidate power.
And that's why he was killed in the Senate, Sic Semper Tyrannis. Yes, thank you, I passed English. What does the speech have to do with anything?
Some clever man in a suit decided you should say it because your audience is more likely to recognize it than, oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I.
Jeffrey waited for the boy to give any sign of recognition. He was not pleasantly surprised.
You can make it work for you. You're setting forth to bury your opponents, aren't you? But if you defeat them too easily, there's no glory in it for you.
Taze nodded, his mouth quirking slightly.
Praising and burying worthy opponents. I can do that.
Yes, you're burying Caesar and you're burying the American team. And all the possible parallels between that empire and the Roman one can go unspoken, because no one will recognize more than the first few lines of the speech. to say nothing of the Russian team, who might be Cassius in this reading.
Right.
Taze drew the word out.
Sure.
The boy couldn't be much over 20. Who knew what English courses he'd had in high school, and what shoddy interpretations a teacher had tried to pound into a bored, hyper-athletic student? Geoffrey sighed.
Forget the Russians. Forget Cassius. Stick to burying people who are full of themselves but hard to kill. Rah, rah, go team. Yay!
Okay, thanks.
Taze went out onto the ice, mumbling his speech to himself.
That could have been worse,
Geoffrey said under his breath. Geoffrey ran his hands through his hair and did not tear any of it out at all.
Do you have a brother? Or better yet, a band of them?
He laughed hopefully.
I have a little sister,
said Crosby. It was a mercy his jersey didn't read King Henry V, since that would be a patent lie. The mental image of a young girl toddling into the scrum of men on sharp blades made Geoffrey wince.
You wouldn't bring her into battle, would you?
Battle? No.
There was still a possibility she was a bellicose girl.
Would you want her at your side in a hockey game? Playing left wing, or whatever it is you call it?
God, no.
Crosby looked offended and hunched his shoulders, as if he wanted to protect her honor.
Sorry, okay, we'll try something else.
She's a goalie.
Oh.
Geoffrey pinched the bridge of his nose.
What do you say to her before a game?
If anything, that made Crosby's frown worse.
We don't talk before games. It's bad luck.
The only way to survive in a high-strung troupe of actors was to know when to get out of the way. Actors were seldom as well-armed as this crowd.
Would you look at the time? I have to go help Hamlet now. Delete this section. The last 5 minutes are off the record since the Hamlet torture began,
Geoffrey told the cameraman firmly. Sorry, buddy. No can do. I have to bring it all in. The cameraman cleared his throat. They're probably not going to use it, though. Only the good takes. There couldn't be anything patriotically inspiring about a director weeping over the delivery of a soliloquy for all the wrong reasons. Geoffrey hoped the cameraman was right, and that the editors had the sense to cut well before to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, no matter how apt the line would be for hockey if it were delivered well by a Hamlet who knew what he was saying. It hadn't been, especially not when interspersed with a player in question, a Mr. Niedermeyer, taking shots on goal, in case anyone could imagine that the speech was about anything other than being or not being a winner. Geoffrey had only cried for a little while. During a water break, Crosby skated up to Geoffrey.
Excuse me, Mr. Tennant, John said he only has to do 3 lines, and you said they would cut most of them.
Probably, yes,
Geoffrey said, wondering which one was John. He'd been turning over the idea of adding more of the speech and starting Crosby with, then shall our names familiar in his mouth as household words, and then some half-assed attempt at making the player's name scan. It would be a sin against the bard, but it might also get fans' attention.
Why do I have to do a whole paragraph?
Geoffrey discarded the concept of explaining that in verse. One spoke of stanzas, not of paragraphs.
Because people in the front office have no sense of proportion, or, in fact, any sense to speak of.
Yeah, most of them have no idea what we can do,
Crosby said, and nearly smiled. With hockey teams' stratospheric budgets, they ought to be able to afford better middle management than the average theater. Geoffrey winced in unexpected sympathy.
Well, the speech you're reading is full of familiar phrases, but it's not familiar in its entirety. The lines they've given you leave out the bulk of the original speech.
Oh,
Crosby nodded.
So it's not the whole thing, it's a soundbite version.
Geoffrey's heart leapt, and he got to his feet before Crosby lost that thought.
Yes, that's an excellent way to think of it. The soundbite version of St. Crispin's Day is exactly what they want from you. I'll gather your army, we'll get the cameras in place, and let's try it again.
The one improvement in this reading over the previous ones was that Crosby smiled, but he appeared to have an unnatural ability to sound thoroughly bored whilst smiling. No one even giggled at, "Hold their manhoods cheap." Not that they should in context, but by that point in the speech they were all looking stoically bored. Geoffrey sighed.
That was a little closer,
he lied.
We'll try it again later.
You forgot to tell everyone you're going to give it your best,
Puck said, nudging Crosby with his shoulder.
Yeah, we're playing. I mean, acting. For the folks back home.
Taze nodded solemnly.
For national pride.
Hey, I'm doing my best, assholes,
Crosby said.
Can we have someone else start the speech?
Puck asked Jeffrey, his eyes too wide to make him look innocent.
Like an assist?
No,
Jeffrey said firmly.
There's only one scene with two people in it.
The two defensemen were defensive in the extreme.
I get the part about he jests at scars who never felt a wound, okay,
said one, whose jersey called him Keith, a barely passable surname. His teammates called him Dunks, and Jeffrey had no idea how one got from the former to the latter, or why anyone would give a hockey player a basketball player's nickname, but none of their nicknames appeared to make any sense whatsoever. It would be easier to think of him as Romeo for all practical purposes. He was more or less the right age, and he snuck furtive glances at his scene partner often enough that Jeffrey was half convinced the speech assignment hadn't been at random. Alas, there was nothing of the young lover about him.
And, yeah, I'd be fucked out there on the ice without Soobzy.
Keith, or Dunks, or potentially Romeo, knocked his shoulder against his teammates.
But we're not, you know, in love. And we don't have to play against each other.
Soobzy, nay, Seabrook, winced at his words and knocked the body check.
That would be fucking awful. I'm glad you're not rushing or something.
Jeffrey smiled.
Use it.
Use what?
Soobzy looked around. His other teammates were shouting lines back and forth at each other, interspersed with curses and stick-handling practice.
That feeling. How much it would suck if you had to play against each other.
Keith Romeo scowled.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be, like, romantic.
That is the core of the play.
Jeffrey stood up and pointed to each goal.
You're on that side.
He gave Keith Romeo a look rather than attempt a name. Dunks, Rose, or Montague.
And you're on that side.
To Soobzy Juliet Capulet.
What you want is to be together, but you can't.
Fuck,
Soobzy said, squaring his shoulders.
Okay, let's try it. Fast. I don't want to think about this for long.
It's getting late,
Jeffrey said to his so-called Puck, who was also a flower by any other name, or a flurry and therefore suited to another role. Though the defensemen had gotten through their balcony scene well enough in the end, Flower might have been better off as Peas Blossom with nothing to do but chime in.
Are you ready to try yours again?
I will not swear this time,
Puck said, making an X over his heart with one gloved hand. His goalie mask hid his expression and his soul patch, leaving Jeffrey wondering why anyone had thought he should try to act in all his gear.
And I will get it right.
It's not just you.
Jeffrey looked at the others, who seemed to have infinite energy when it came to skating and no tolerance at all for acting.
I know this isn't easy, but saying a few words shouldn't be so hard.
Sorry, we're trying, especially Sid.
Jeffrey squeezed his eyes shut.
Yes, he's very trying. No, that is, I know he is.
He's just, well...
Puck shrugged.
Not very good at this. Neither am I. Sorry, we do our best.
Could you say that again in Elizabethan English?
Jeffrey asked.
In what?
Speak the speech, I pray you.
Jeffrey sighed at the blank cage of the goalie's mask.
One more time from the beginning.
I'm sorry, Mr. Tennant, but you need to clear the rink for the next practice.
The rink manager said. Her eyes kept darting to the players behind him as if she couldn't believe they were in her facility.
Your scheduled time ended half an hour ago.
This is ridiculous, said a woman beside her who was holding an 8-year-old girl by the hand and glowering with the force of a mother scorned. Why didn't you stop them the moment their time ended? When my Mackenzie's practice wasn't finished on time, the coach had to continue outside.
Yes, Miss DeLong, we're usually very careful about our schedule, but...
But you made an exception for these theatrical maniacs of all people, Mrs. DeLong glowered at Jeffrey. After all the trouble you actors have caused in this town, running around like hooligans, stealing cars, and rioting in the streets, I'd hope you had a sense of shame. Mackenzie tugged on her mother's sleeve.
Mommy, they're not actors.
Yes, they are, sweetie. Mrs. DeLong patted her daughter's hand. But don't worry, we'll get them out of here.
No, your daughter is absolutely right,
Jeffrey said with the same relief.
Let me talk to them for a moment, and we'll be on our way.
Immediately, said Mrs. DeLong.
Do they have to go?
Asked Mackenzie, looking from her mother to Jeffrey.
Don't make them leave.
You have practice, her mother said sternly. Mackenzie's eyes were wide and heartbroken.
But that's Sidney Crosby, Mommy.
No, dear, it's... Mrs. DeLong looked up. Crosby waved at them, his soundbite smile looking more real by the moment. Oh, said Mrs. DeLong.
I think they might have a little time to talk to their biggest fans,
Jeffrey said.
I'll find out.
The practice of the new Burbage Girl Groundlings began late and turned into a mob scene of girls between the ages of 8 and 10, staring at the hockey players and asking them to sign things. It took all of 5 minutes for the throng to turn into a hockey game, with hulking men dodging among the tiny children. Jeffrey hid on the bench where he'd spent most of the day. The Groundlings coach stepped beside him when the play paused for one reason or another. She was starry-eyed under her brush cut and occasionally saying, "Wow," with an awe equal to her young charges. After more than enough of this, Jeffrey offered,
"We're not done yet. I could take them back to the theater."
"We have a game tomorrow," the coach said. "But they're not going to get another chance to meet players this great for a long time, if they ever do. Let them enjoy it."
"Huh."
Jeffrey stood up and yelled,
"Crosby!"
It was a miracle no girls were killed in his speedy arrival at the bench.
"Yes, Mr. Tennant?"
"Is talking to anybody before a game bad luck?"
"No, just my sister. And some other people, but nobody who's here."
"Okay, here's what we're going to do."
The series of commercials that came out of the collaboration had minimal Shakespearean content. The first one to air started with Taze's pretentious,
"Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears,"
and not a syllable more, followed by a crashing brass and shots of hockey players scrambling for possession of the puck. They released the commercials out of order, to Jeffrey's mind. The second one was Puck's closing speech. It played in all its slightly halting glory over a shot of two goalies in the same goal, one half the height of the other. The taller one helped the little one up when she dove for a shot, and they gave each other a high five. Some bright spark in the advertising firm decided that the Romeo and Juliet scene deserved a blurry lens and swelling violins. The blurs did not make the players look any more like teenagers in love, though they did obscure a few misguided attempts at emoting. Thankfully, the ad cut to images from the most recent New Burbage production after a few scenes of pained defensemen to give viewers some concept of what the play should be. Jeffrey turned off or ran away from the Hamlet commercial every time he saw it, no matter how many times, Ellen said.
"It's not that bad. Not bad enough that you have to leave the room. I'm sorry, Jeffrey, but really, we're in the middle of dinner,"
he said.
"I don't want to know,"
over and over again until he was fairly sure she believed him. The commercial that got the most hits on YouTube, whatever that meant, was a bastardization of Shakespeare most unlike Jeffrey, as everyone from Darren Nichols to Oliver told him in a variety of tones of voice. He waved all their objections aside.
"We did the real text too, but it never worked as well."
"Are you telling me that you, Jeffrey fucking Tennant, couldn't inspire one athlete to talk to his teammates before a game?"
Darren asked, his laughter edged.
"It's the easiest set speech in the canon for someone whose life revolves around the glorification of traditional masculine pastimes and raising violence to an art form."
"I'd like to see you try it,"
Jeffrey said, and immediately regretted the words. He disclaimed all responsibility for Darren's made-for-TV Richard III on Ice ever after. On the other hand, he acknowledged that he'd worked on the Olympics promotion. Despite the changes to the text, there were parts of it he was proud of. Anna set one of the stills from the most popular ad as her work background until the season, the theater season, of course, began. Every time Jeffrey stopped by her computer, there were parts of it peeking out, reminding him that behind her endless emails and spreadsheets, there was a hockey player, down on one knee in a sea of little girls, all of them shouting,
"We have the sisters!"
loudly enough to drown out any one lone athlete, and beaming like they were all about to take over the world. The end.
Thanks for listening.